Hey.
All right, there we go. Okay. Well, welcome to Women Explore. This is a very special season for us, and we're so glad you're here. We're celebrating 50 years and still exploring. That this is our 50th anniversary series of discussions and lectures, and we're here together. This marks our fifth one in our 10-week series. We've done them on Zoom so far, but we're going to do two in person in the next 5 weeks. One is a nature walk in Mount Auburn Cemetery, and one is getting together with Two Story Theater, a favorite of ours for many years. So we welcome you to go the distance with us and celebrate what was created 50 years ago and celebrate Liz Dotson Gray's vision, the things that were near and dear to her heart, ecofeminism and women's rights and the spirituality of the divine feminine and a deep love for the earth and a deep searching for how do we love her? How do we care for her? How do we advocate for her? These were all woven through what Liz supported in creating and what she loved and what she dearly stood for in her life's actions. So we're here to honor her as well, and of course her quest for knowledge, which we are still exploring and tending and encouraging. So we try to be thoughtful, original, and provocative in what we present and what we discuss, and make a series that she feels proud of. And we've had some of our favorite speakers so far, and we have somebody today who was one of our directors, Mona Killingback. So we are enjoying the past and celebrating the future and moving into the future and then celebrating and learning about right now. I'm really struck by our 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. We had 45 people on the screen for Zoom. It was fun to gather and celebrate 100 years of women's suffrage. It's harder to gather with our topic today, which is feminism, feminism's gains at risk, and how do we stem the tide? So we're gathering here bravely to face, obviously, the grief that we've experienced and what we know to be true in our hearts and what's heartbreaking and what's hopeful. So I want to introduce first Barb Vilandrie. She's going to do our focus. And Barb began her career working for Shawmut Bank, first in operations and then in human resources, handling employee communications and activities. Shawmut awarded Barbara a scholarship to Simmons College to attend a specially designed undergraduate management program sponsored by the National Association of Banking Women. She continued at Simmons, earning her master's degree in communication management. Barbara moved to academia, where she became assistant director of her graduate program at Simmons College. From there, she became chair of the communications program at Hester College in Manchester, New Hampshire, where she developed and managed a program in radio and television broadcasting and a program in public relations. Her home and garden have been her salvation during the pandemic, where she has quarantined with her husband and her pet poodle. So let's welcome Barbara to bring us into the focus today.
Good morning.
And would everyone please mute as Barbara talks? We'll have time for discussion later.
I'm hoping you will bear with me as I spend some time walking down my own memory lane. I've been asked to talk about the changes I've seen happening for women in my lifetime. I grew up in the 50s when there was an expectation that little girls would play with dolls and have imaginary tea parties. I had a miniature porcelain tea set my grandmother gave me. I loved it when she explained all the conventions of socializing while we would pretend to sip tea. I cherished those moments. But when I was in my own home, I loved playing cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians with the boy next door in his basement. I don't know how many other little girls did this. I never had girlfriends as confidants. My mom tried to get me interested in dolls, but that really was never going to be my thing. Finally, she settled on buying me something called storybook dolls that were exquisitely costumed small dolls designed for display. I kept them in their original boxes up in my cupboard, high above the closet, and they only came out when someone special came to visit, like my cousin. Other than that, I could be found outside, hanging upside down off the bars of the swing set and walking the top of the fence with the boy next door. That was my safe place, my happy place. When our extended family met for dinner at the country club, I had beautiful dresses that I loved to wear. I understood that when the family was in public, I was expected to be well behaved. I always acted like a young lady. My mom worked 6 days a week in her father's jewelry store. I knew that all my friends' moms didn't work, but I never gave that much thought. Fast forward to today's world when I bought my great niece a tea set that I have yet to give her. I have no idea if in today's world this is an appropriate gift for a little girl. I definitely have not bought her a doll for fear of pushing her into a stereotype of what a little girl should be interested in. Last summer, I was truly astonished when my nephew sent me a video of his 3-year-old boy and 5-year-old girl riding bucking lambs at the annual rodeo. That was an expectation I would never have thought I could do. I might have done it in this day and age, but I was sort of intrigued and horrified. And without living in proximity to these kids, buying gifts is a guessing game. I want to reflect a little just on my history growing up and what I've seen. When I was in middle school, I had a girlfriend who was desperately ill once a month every time she got period. I knew nobody who got sick like she did. And the nurse at middle school would not send her home. She literally had to endure for the entire day. And my guess is that wouldn't happen today. And if it did, the nurse and administration would be answering to my friend's parents and perhaps an attorney. In high school, girls, the style was to have these very big bouffant hairdos. I remember sleeping with my hair wrapped around giant curlers. I don't know if you have that experience or not, but it wasn't easy. I can't imagine any girl doing that today. The girls in high school were all required to wear dresses and nylons. This was before pantyhose, so they were individual nylons with some of them with seams going up the back that had to be kept straight, held up by a garter strap or a girdle. So comfortable. A couple years later, I went back to the high school to visit one of my instructors, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The girls were wearing pants, the guys were wearing colorful print shirts. It looked really comfortable, but it was a difficult thing to wrap my mind around, and that change came fast. In college, I will always remember attending an evening lecture of a visiting poet. I was enjoying the lecture when I realized that I had to get up and leave because there was a 10 o'clock curfew at my dorm. And I left all of the guys sitting there enjoying the lecture and probably staying to kibitz with the poet after the fact while I had to beat it back to the dorm. And I thought that that was so totally unfair. Then there was the time when I accompanied two of my house mothers to dinner. Yes, house mothers. Those were a thing in my college experience. And they invited a female student to join who was a law student. And I was pretty intrigued that she was training to be a lawyer, but it never occurred to me that I could do the same thing. I had a subscription at college for the Congressional Record, which I was reading, but I couldn't make the leap to think that I could become a lawyer. When I reflect on that at this age, I'm stunned. But what I did instead was come to Boston to train to be a court reporter. The school recommended that I stay at the Franklin Square House, a woman's residence in Roxbury, When I arrived with my footlocker and suitcase, they put me in a tiny long room that was so much smaller than the single I had in college. Then I learned that I had a 10 o'clock curfew. I was beside myself. Not that I was planning to close all the bars in Boston every night, because I wasn't, but I've never done well with arbitrary rules, and this struck me as an arbitrary rule. I found a brand new YWCA residence just opening on Clarendon Street in Boston. I reserved a room, turned up at the desk at the Franklin's Warehouse with my trunk and suitcase, told them I was leaving, took a cab to the new YWCA where a lovely room was awaiting me and where there was no curfew. It was 8 blocks from my court reporting school, and on a good day, I could walk there. Later, after I was married, I made friends with a woman who was at the Franklin Square House at the same time that I was there. She was amazed the staff let me leave. My guess is that I looked older and professional, and they didn't think I was a student and nobody was going to get in my way. I never became a court reporter. I was working at Chalmette Bank in operations, and the bank kept promoting me. My husband and I were married in 1968. At the time, it never occurred to me to keep my maiden name. The idea was just gathering momentum, but hadn't really come to the forefront. Having said that, there was one male officer at the bank whose wife insisted that he take her name. I never quite wrapped my mind around that one either. Today, I'm coming to terms with the fact that husband and wife are terms that are not being used. At least I don't hear them being used much. And instead, people are using the term partner, which is something that I always associated with gay couples. Sometimes it's just hard to keep up with all these changes. Around 1979, there were many more young women college grads hired at the bank into jobs that had never before been filled by women. One of the things that struck me was that they all were dressing in identical outfits, pinstripe suits with a little white shirt and then this silk tie at the top. They were attempting to look like their male counterparts. The fact that none of these women just seemed to have any sense of style that they were expressing was making me seriously nuts. Somewhere in the mid-1980s, one of the female banking officers I was friends with became pregnant. I was going to take maternity leave, and at that point, I was working in personnel. She was one of the few women VPs. The bank administration, all men, was in a tither thinking that she couldn't hold on to her VP title if she wasn't working full time. I don't know what went on in the back rooms, but they finally came to their senses and allowed her to keep her title. She had her baby, returned to have a very successful banking career that included bringing a lot of money into the banking profession. About that same time, Governor King ran a conference at Harvard that was centered on family and children. It was the first session of the afternoon, and I thought maybe I'd had too big a lunch and just was half asleep and not paying attention because I did a real double take, thinking that I had misheard the speaker. He was predicting a phenomenal increase in single heads of households. He was chronicling what turned out to be a major cultural shift. More women were choosing to have children without marrying the father, or were marrying the father but were not staying in the marriage. And there were more women and men who were choosing not to marry or to have children. And that makes me reflect back to a month before my high school graduation, when the female graduates of both high schools were required to attend an event sponsored by the Association of University Women. The soon-to-be high school graduates showed up all dressed in heels, wearing hats and gloves that matched their outfits. I'm sitting there listening to one of these speakers up on the podium telling the audience that there was an order to living our lives. We should go to college, find a husband, get our degree, marry, and have our children. I remember wanting to get up and walk out. Not that I had any other plans to do it a different way. I don't know that I'd even thought about what I was doing next, but I thought it was truly audacious and presumptuous for this woman to tell these high school seniors how to live their lives. And I think about it occasionally. I can't imagine her horror as she watched the American social order turn upside down in the two decades that followed. The birth control pill came on the market in 1960, and for the first time, women had access to a reliable form of birth control. The 1960s was labeled the decade of the sexual revolution. Free love was talked about a lot, and Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco was identified as the center of the counterculture. That didn't impact me. I was a traditional college student for less than a year in Montana in 1963. I was in Boston in 1966, training to be a court reporter and working at the bank. I was married in 1968. Having said that, the pill was what I used for birth control until 1979, when I had my tubes. Unlike a lot of women, I didn't seem to have a ticking biological clock. The one time my husband and I talked about having a child, I asked him if he would come into the delivery room with me. That was something, a practice that was pretty new, but people were doing it and it was being written about. And he was very, very clear saying, no, he would not do that. And I was very clear saying, then we need to drop this idea. And that was the end of that. In my pilot undergraduate degree at Simmons, which consisted of banking women whose banks gave them fellowships to attend this special program to earn their degree, almost all of them deferred having children until they were older, some into their 40s. And interestingly enough, when I was 24, I was seeing a GYN who told me that if I was going to have children, to have them in my 20s when I had the energy to keep up with them. I thought and wondered about having children when you're older, because I think that makes you a different kind of mother, not necessarily a better mother, just a different kind of mother. But from my vantage point, it looks to me like my classmates have been very successful in their roles as moms. My guess is there are trade-offs between having children when you were younger versus when you were older. And I'd love to see the research that in fact chronicles this phenomenon. I want to share with you one morning when I was at Simmons. We lived on campus for 2-week sessions, and there were six of them. But I was getting ready for class, and somebody was banging at the door. And I raced to get it, and the gal in the class behind me was at the door in tears. I mean, she was just close to hysterical. And she had the Wall Street Journal she was holding up. On the front page was a story about two of our bank's senior vice presidents, both married, not to one another, who were having an affair. When the dust settled, the man was allowed to keep his job. The woman was not. I don't know how that would play out in today's world. I think that would depend on whether it was a headline in the Wall Street Journal. But my guess is it would depend on who the players were. At one of Simmons' leadership conferences, I listened to Whoopi Goldberg, who had just come from a Women's March on Washington. She talked about, and she did a lecture, you know, on the square for them. And she talked about bringing a coat hanger to show her young D.C. audience that this is what was used before Roe versus Wade. This is what women sometimes did if they needed to abort. Today, I watched the news coverage of how difficult some states are making it for women to have an abortion since Roe versus Wade was overturned. I can't help thinking that some of these state legislators have a real wish to be part of the Taliban. It seems to me that subjecting women to their rules, no matter how restrictive, is right up their alley. Not just us. One of the cultural shifts that I'm still coming to terms with is the husband who stays at home and takes care of the kids while the wife works. In my neighborhood, I see men, young men, wheeling baby carriages on the street during the day, taking the baby out for some fresh air. Trust me, when I was growing up, there was never a man on the street pushing a baby carriage. It simply would not have been accepted. But this, however, is a different time, and if it had been a different time, I can't help but think my parents might have adopted that model if it had been accepted. My dad had wonderful parenting skills, and my mom didn't particularly have an interest in parenting at all. So it would have been a model that would have worked for them. Just sort of want to share with you one other experience. When my husband and I were first dating in Boston, we had gotten into an argument, and he pushed me, which really frightened me. And somehow I ended up at the local police department, which wasn't very far away, to see if they could help. I'm not sure what I expected them to do. However, going there was a really bad idea, and they made that crystal clear to me. Their policy was not to get involved in a domestic dispute, and I was quickly rushed out and put back on the street where they thought I belonged. Today, if I went to the police, I believe they would be required at least to listen to me and probably to follow up. That's a huge change because a woman's voice is finally heard. I had a childhood friend named Lauren, who I grew up with from very young age, who was working in California in a different career, and she decided she wanted to make a transition into film. And she wrote Jane Fonda and told her she admired her and wanted to work for her. Jane hired her to find scripts that her production company could produce, and through her, she hired a friend of mine who then took care of Jane Fonda's children when they were young, so it sort of worked out in multiple ways. Because of Fonda's connection in Hollywood, she was one of the first women to form her own production company. After 5 years working for Jane, Lauren formed her own production company, which successfully produced three films. That was possible, although not easy, because women were just beginning to get a foot in the door, getting jobs that had always been the providence of men. Another high school friend, Lorianne, went to MIT for her freshman year and earned C's, I might add. And when she came home, her father made it perfectly clear he was not paying this kind of money for her to earn C's. And she could finish her undergraduate degree at Montana State University, which she did. She went on to earn her PhD at BU and went on to be one of the first women to head up a division at NIH. She has two accomplished daughters, one of whom is an oncologist specializing in brain cancer at Einstein in New York. That would have been a career that was unthinkable for a girl and her mom when I were in, for, I'm sorry, for my girlfriend and for my friend and I when we were in high school. So yes, I have seen lots of things change for women, and I've had many of my own expectations drastically altered. And as encouraging as these changes have been, I've also been distressed to see the backlash created by folks who want things to be the way they always were. The speed of change may depend on your perspective. For a lot of us, these changes have been very slow in coming. But for some, they have come too fast for them to accept and to embrace.
Thank you, Barbara. Wow, that was quite a tour through these last decades. Yeah, sure, it resonated with many of us in many different places. So our schedule today.